I'd like to thank the Fields Institute for this opportunity to talk, and to my colleagues for coming. I'm a combinatorialist, and I'm also interested in aspects of combinatorics which have impact on algebraic geometry. So this is a talk in three parts. The first part is an introductory part to explain to people what graphs and surfaces are, or at least the surfaces which I should be looking at. And the next part is to do with the map series, and I'm going to speak briefly about two applications. One to mathematical physics, one of the models of string theory, and then to the moduli space of algebraic curves, which is something I'm working on at the present moment. And the third part is going to be somewhat more technical, if there's a specialist here in the area of algebraic geometry and algebraic combinatorics. So this is joint work over a considerable number of years with George Andrews and Ian Goulden, John Hara, Malcolm Perry, Alex Weinstein, Ravi Vakil, and Terry Vizintin, a mixture of people in physics and special functions and combinatorics and geometry. Oh, I'm starting at the very beginning. This is what a graph is. It's a collection of points just joined up by lines. This picture is necessarily drawn on a two-dimensional surface. So necessarily it looks as if it's embedded in two dimensions, but you're not meant to think like that. And it looks as if the lines are straight, and that is important. In fact, it's not. The only thing which is important is that there are five points there, and they are connected in pairs. So there's this wiggly thing in which everything has been distorted, but that incidence information is maintained. The surfaces which I shall be concerned with, or some of them, have a very nice classification according to genus. So there's the sphere. At the top, its genus is zero. There's the torus, which is a sphere with a handle. That allows one to put graphs in surfaces and to build a bridge so that the edges don't cross. And a double torus, that's a sphere with two handles, and a triple torus, and so on, for arbitrary G. I've only mentioned the oriental surfaces. Surfaces on which you can consistently specify a clockwise and anti-clockwise sense. I've made no comments here about the non-oriental surfaces, although I think I have a picture of one later. So the first part of this talk is concerned with the embedding of graphs on surfaces. So there's the familiar cube, and you can almost believe that is a cube itself, the familiar cube. There is an embedding on the sphere. Notice that the red edges meet only at the dots, and they don't cross. So a condition of the definition of an embedding as a two-cell embedding is when you delete the red edges, then the surface on which you are embedding decomposes into a union of open discs. In the top pair of diagrams, which are equivalent, there's a pair of spheres. One very much looks like a sphere, and the other doesn't. But the second diagram, the one which looks like a malformed kidney, that is a sphere which has been deformed by smooth operations. There's been no superficial cutting or a slicing and re-sewing of the surface. And you can see that on the left-hand side there is an embedding of the cube as a two-cell embedding on that surface. On the right-hand side, the same graph is embedded. It's still the cube, although it's all been twisted and malformed. But something remains. Certain properties of incidence of edges with vertices remains, and also therefore the circulation, the clockwise circulation of the incidence of edges with vertices. So that's indicated just on one vertex there, which corresponds to this one. There's an anti-clockwise circulation, and there's an anti-clockwise circulation. And if I were to label the vertices, you'd see that the edges enter this one in the same way that they enter that one, and vice versa. And here is a picture of a very simple-looking graph, just a figure of eight on the torus. That's the sphere with one handle. Notice that that this loop meets this loop only at that vertex. It meets nowhere else. And there's a deformation of the surface and a consequent deformation of the graph. And but the clockwise circulation around the vertex is maintained because there is no there's no cutting of the surface. Well, returning to the embedding of the cube on the sphere, here there's a picture in which the edges have been deleted, and so the surface is now going to fall apart along those cut lines. It's going to fall into six faces. So there are clearly eight vertices. There are 12 edges. You can count them. And then there are six faces. The dotted lines are meant to be behind the sphere. And then by the Euler and polyhedral formula, you can take the alternating sum of the number of vertices, number of edges, and number of faces, and that gives you a topological invariance for the surface, 2 minus 2g. G is the genus, g equals 0, and this embedding corresponds to the sphere as we saw before. Here is an attempt at embedding a loop on the surface of the torus. When you delete it and straighten the result out, you get a cylinder, which is not a two-cell. And so that is not a two-cell. That is not a two-cell embedding, and it's not something which I'm interested in here for the present purposes. But on the other hand, if you take that figure eight, and then first of all take this blue edge and delete it, which is denoted by that white loop, and then you open out the torus, then you get this this diagram, and then there's the red edge which you now delete, and that opens up into this, which is a disk, homomorphic to a disk. So this is a two-cell. This is a two-cell embedding of a graph on the torus, and the and it only has one face. Again, you can do this alternating sum of 2 minus 2g equals the alternating sum of the number of vertices and edges and faces, and when you do it, you get g equals 1. And so this is clearly on the torus. It has one handle. Well, here's a picture of a Klein bottle. Really, you can't draw pictures of the Klein bottle. It's a standard thing. It's got an obstruction. It looks like a garden hose, rather ugly coloured garden hose, and a hole is bored in the side of the hose, and then this part of the hose is drawn through, pulled up, and then cemented at the top there. And so this is what it looks like inside. And if you take a little disc and then you stick a post on that disc with a red flag, if you move that configuration in the surface, you can come back to the same point with it pointing in the other direction. So there's no consistent sense of clockwise and anti-clockwise. These are surfaces which I shall be considering, but I shall sort of gloss over them quickly. Oops. Okay. So I want to mention very briefly the embedding theorem. Here's the original graph. There are two edges incident with this vertex, three with this. And when you make a list, it's a collection of integers which I've sorted into weakly increasing order. This is called a partition, and it's a partition of its sum. That's 6 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2, which is 12. Here is an embedding on the sphere. It's the same graph, and this blue face is bounded by four edges. That corresponds to this. The face which one is tempted to call an outer face, but really isn't, is this yellow face. It's closed at the back. That is bounded by five edges, and then this one is bounded by three edges. So we get another partition, again of 12, and that I will call the face degree or the face partition, vertex degrees and vertex partitions, and they're all specified by properties of incidence. Well, I need an encoding of this thing to do what I want to do. And so here is an encoding. First of all, I'm going to choose an edge and distinguish it. And I've done so by having a double-headed arrow. And in combinatorics, this is called the root. And when this is given an embedding on the sphere, it means that the automorphism group of this geometrical configuration is the identity. It looks like a restriction, a condition placed on something general, but in everything which people use these things for, it's the rooted case which is important. So I've taken this graph, I've added a sign to indicate that that's the root edge, and now what I'm going to do is to label that one, and I'm going to label the other edges indiscriminately from 1 to 6, there being 6 edges. And I'm also going to add directions. I'm going to orient each edge, and that is completely at random. I've done those arbitrarily. And I'm going to count these things, because the counting function turns out to be something which is really quite important. And so what I'm doing here is to count rooted decorated maps, and then afterwards I want to go to some extent to remove the decoration. I'm going to denote the head of each edge by a plus sign and the tail of each edge by a minus sign. And when you see that plus sign, you're to read 5 super plus and 5 super minus, and so on for the other edges. And there's a consistent way of specifying anti-clockwise circulation around each vertex. And this is because we're working on an orientable surface. And out of these red circles, I'm going to write down these cycles of a permutation. So, for example, on this one, there's a 4 plus, and moving anticlockwise, there's a 6 minus and a 5 minus. That forms a 3 cycle in this permutation, which has 6 disjoint cycles. This is the disjoint cycle representation of a permutation in S12, the symmetric group on 12 symbols. And here is a 6.3 involution in S12. It's the edge permutation, because each cycle, a 2 cycle, is defined by I plus I minus. It's defined by an edge and the symbols at either end of the edge. So this is, in fact, canonical. And what I claim is that, it's a theorem which goes back right to the way to the late 1800s. This, in fact, specifies the embedding of a graph on a surface, and by this I mean the vertex permutation mu. That is to say, if you give me this information, I can always reconstruct that, because that is a canonical permutation. And the theorem says that the theorem says something rather more powerful. The theorem says that if you want to find out the faces, you can look at the cycles of this permutation, the product of nu with epsilon, because after all, that's just turning around. Well, if you apply epsilon first with multiplication on the right, on the left, epsilon takes you to the end of this edge, then nu takes you around that corner. So this is rather like keeping your the palm of your hand on a wall and going along this face of the room, then turning anticlockwise so you meet this face, and then so on. And that describes a closed cell, and it's the face of the graph. Moreover, it's computed algebraically and not geometrically out of actually drawing the model and looking at it. So that's an algebraic computation of the face structure. Okay, so what does that product look like? There's the product phi equals nu epsilon. Notice that there's a 1 plus 3 minus 4 plus 4 plus. You just have to believe me that when you multiply this with the canonical 6.3 involution that you actually get this, then there's 1 plus corresponding to 1 plus. There's there's 3 minus, there's 3 minus, there's 5 plus, and there's 4 plus, there's 5 plus, and there's 4 plus. So this is a permutation in S12. It is the disjoint cycle representation of that permutation, and it gives these cycles. Notice that you can actually see on this diagram that they are pointwise disjoint. And this fragment is a fragment not of the outer face, because this is on a sphere. There's no point at infinity. It's just the other face, which goes around the back. And moreover, obviously, if you write down the number of elements in each cycle, you get 2, 2, 3, 2, 3. And that is the vertex partition. If you look at the number of cycles here, you get 3, 4, 5. And that is the face partition. So all of this topological information is in fact contained within this and within this computation. So we've now reduced the discovery of these faces to a purely algebraic computation. Oops. Okay, part two. Oops, I forgot to start my thingy. Let's start it now. An embedding of a graph in a surface is a map, and I'm going to be looking at rooted maps. So now comes the slightly ugly part. I hope everybody's willing to take this. What I'm going to do is to sum over all maps, Gothic M, in this set of all maps, which are on orientable surfaces, and I can limit all of their vertex degrees to belong to a set A, which I choose. And later on, I want to change this set A and see what I get. So just imagine building models of all these possible graphs embedded on all possible orientable surfaces, and then summing up all of this. You'll get a great huge series in these indeterminates, X, U, X, Y, and Z. You will get a contribution of 1 for each map. And then when you add it all up, this coefficient of u to the g, x to the I, y to the j, z to the k, in this series, this rather odd-looking series formed on this set, is obviously precisely the number of maps in this set, with genus g, I vertices, j faces, and k edges. So I don't want to compute any numbers. I want to find out properties of this series. I want to see what magical properties it has, if any. So if you can just bear this thing in mind, this might escape your memories, this set A. I'm going to limit A to be the set consisting of 4 alone. So in that case, all of the faces will be bounded by 4 edges, by 4 edges, and a cube is an instance of that. And then the other set I will be interested in is where this set A disappears, and that is when I have absolutely no constraints on the vertex degrees. That's right. It's a great infinite series. But it is in the ring of formal power series in the variable Z, or the indeterminate Z, with a coefficient ring, which is in U, X, and Y over the complexes. I can say that is over the rationals, but one may as well not fuss and use an algebraically closed field. Because if I fix the number of edges, then there's a finite number of graphs which can be drawn, a finite number of maps. So that's why this is finite tree, giving a polynomial ring as the coefficient ring. Right, thank you. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So, it would be nice to have an expression for this. Well, it turns out that the series which I want is... Well, you do something to this series. So I've now got to tell you what this series is. This series is this. Well, here you see a vertex permutation being written, being multiplied on the right by the edge permutation. And then that is intersected with the conjugacy classes. These are conjugacy classes in S2N. This is then saying what the faces are. So this is, in fact, implementing the embedding theorem. Combinatorially, so this is almost definitional, and I have recorded the number of vertices. That's just the number of symbols in this partition new. So that's just its length, the number of integers which turn up. The number of integers in here is this L of phi. It's the number of faces. So here I'm losing all of the information about the degrees of vertices and the degrees of edges. And I take the logarithm of this because if I give you an arbitrary permutation nu in S2n, and then I take my canonical fixed point tree involution, and I do the geometrical construction, I don't necessarily get a connected object. In fact, I get a pre-map, which is a union of maps, each on its own surface. This logarithm is an enumerative thing which just looks after that. This use of the logarithm was known to Horowitz, for example, in the turn of in the late 1800s. What else can be said? This derivative, d by dz multiplied by z and these twos and a division by two, completely removes the declaration. Remember that I added orientations at the beginning. The two removes them in those strategic places. Two is associated with that z, with an edge and not with the root edge. And the derivative neatly removes the labeling. So this is, and this now counts rooted maps devoid of the declaration which I wanted to do at the beginning. Okay, so that explains all of that. So how can one carry on any further with this? Well, I'm going to work in the group algebra of the symmetric group S2n over C, and there are some very standard facts about it. Let C sub alpha be a conjugacy class indexed by alpha, which is a partition, and think of that as a natural index for the face structure or the vertex structure of a map. This is a formal sum, and that symbol, capital K sub alpha, is simply a formal sum of all n elements in this conjugacy class, and it's a finite sum. These elements span the center of the group, and I call that Z sub C S2n. And it's by an obvious computation, almost definitional, it is definitional, that this combinatorial number, which we get from the embedding theorem, can be computed by multiplying these two things and then taking out that coefficient. These generate, well, the center is a sub algebra of this group algebra, and so the product of these two elements lies back in the algebra, so I can look at the coefficient of k sub phi in that. That coefficient of k sub phi is looking after that intersection, and those two things multiplied together is looking after that. Epsilon is in k sub 2n, I should say c sub 2n, but k sub 2n is simply the sum over that set. The center has a basis consisting of orthogonal idempotents. Those are linear combinations of the k-alphas because they lie in the same algebra. And the scalars which are used in these linear combinations are evaluations of irreducible characters of the symmetric group, S2n. And we use the orthogonal idempotents of in the center to say something more about that. We actually compute this. And when you do that, I'm not going to go into any of the details, but when you do that, you get something which is completely free of C sub alpha, of C sub phi and C sub epsilon. R then becomes this sum. There's been, this is the character chi super theta evaluated at the conjugacy class of Sn, S2n indexed by phi. This is the conjugacy class of fixed point free involutions, and it's the character evaluated on fixed point free involutions. And this is a result of a character sum. There is another character, but it's been summed out. And it's in fact simply written as this, where x super k is the rising factorial. Pi sub a is the set of all partitions which have parts in this magic set A, which I haven't said much about. And there are the familiar by now derivatives and logs, and this looks after these inverses. And there's a positive one on as an as an exponent there, look after the embedding theorem. So there it is. There is the map series. What can you do with it? You as sure as heck wouldn't want to do any computation with it, although you can for very small things. What you can prove is that if you limit yourself to the set of either vertex degrees or face degrees, let's say face degrees, you're only allowed face degree 4, then the only maps you can have are quadrangulations. Each face is bounded by four edges. It's an extraordinary fact to me that you can prove this, that the generating series for quadrangulations is related to the generating series for all maps, simply by substituting these indeterminates. Notice that there is a u plus, there's an x plus u and an x minus u. All this thing is doing, all this plus sign and a division by 2, is to take the even subseries with respect to u. So this is just bisection in u. One can therefore just concentrate on this and imagine that the terms in which are odd powers of u have been deleted. No known constructive proof is known for this. No known constructive proof is known for this. No constructive proof is known for this, and it's been out since the 80s. It would be very interesting to have a proof of this based on some kind of topological surgery. It would tell us a lot, as I'll mention later. A similar result holds for triangulations. Maps bounded by faces which have only 3 edges. And the reason that one might be interested in it is, how I first bumped into this was that there was a toy model of two-dimensional quantum gravity. One was called the Phi-4 model, and the other one is called the Penner model. And Penner is a geometer on the West Coast in the U.S. somewhere. And in fact, this thing says that these two models of these early models in the early 90s of two-dimensional quantum gravity are in fact related, and they also say something about quantum chromodynamics. This is taking me far afield. I've listened to one or two physicists trying to explain this, and I find it all mysterious. But it's something to do with quark-antiquark pairs. As time evolves, they emit gluons. If I'm wrong in saying that they emit gluons, my apologies if there are any mathematical physicists here. But gluons appear somehow under time evolution. And if you're not observing this system, then it seems as if the gluons can move backwards in time. So the mutual interactions of these things, as the quark and the antiquark pair evolve as time moves, create some kind of configuration, and the important terms, the dominant terms, correspond to the situation in which these various lines of interaction lie on a surface. And so what is important is that the graph corresponding to this, or the map, has vertices only of degree 3 and 4. And that is the case in which we know we have results. Separately, we don't know whether we take the union of these two cases, but whether these same results hold. But Malcolm Perry and I and Terry Visentine published a paper, a fairly long one, in the Communications in Mathematical Physics about this two-dimensional quantum gravity model. Okay, I want to make this theory a bit more symmetrical, so I'm going to extend it to hypermaps. Hypermaps are simply two-face colorable maps. These are maps in which every edge separates faces of different color. And they are otherwise just the normal vanilla flavored maps which I had before. There's some slightly different terminology. These green things are called hyper edges. the terminology comes from graph theory. I like to call them hypotheses because they are faces, but graph theorists call them hyper edges. The enumerative theory is more symmetrical for these, and I'm not going to go through the algebra. It happens to be the double coset algebra of the hyper octahedral group H2n embedded in H4n as the stabilizer of a fixed point free, of a single matching. So when one does that, what one finds is some pleasant things happen. So some terminology. P sub k is the degree k formal power sum with a set of underlying indeterminates which commute, infinite in number. And it's extended multiplicatively to partitions. Those, remember, these partitions indicate mark face degrees and vertex degrees. So if that were a 4 and a 5, that would be a 4 times P4 times P5. And this is a finitely product. The Jack symmetric functions are orthogonal with respect to this inner product. The inner product in which the inner product of these two power sums, alpha and beta, where alpha and beta partition the same number, is this rather odd-looking thing. L to some power, sum of the parts of alpha factorial divided by the size of the contiguity class, indexed by that. You don't have to worry about that. There is a nice inner product on this space, and the Jack symmetric functions are orthogonal with respect to it. A is the Jack parameter and is an indeterminate. What you can show is that if you let psi be this thing, it's a product of these three Jack symmetric functions at these variables, or indeterminates, which we called vertex degrees, face degrees, and hyper-edge degrees, and you just divide by the norm, take the log. This should be familiar, and this derivative, although it's over a different indeterminate, it says the same function. When you put all of that together, you find that if you evaluate it at zero, then you get the hypermap series for oriental surfaces, and when you put it equal to one, you get the hypermap series for all surfaces. A lot of work goes into doing that. And just to make this clear, if you do a computation over this using Stembridge's symmetric function package, what you find is that the coefficients in this series, the coefficients in B, are polynomials which have positive integer coefficients. And so it is natural to come up with a conjecture which says that this hypermap series is a series for counting hypermaps in which B is an indeterminate which marks an invariant of hypermaps. And it would be curious to know what that is. Well, more than a curiosity, it becomes important. So that's a nice symmetrical form. I say that it's a nice symmetrical form because I've got the product of these three Jack symmetric functions, not distinguished from each other at all, except by having different indeterminates. To make further progress in the direction which I wanted to it's useful to introduce this expectation operator. So these are Rn integrals. This is a sort of Gaussian integral, a Gaussian measure. The square of the van der Mond determinant to the power of a, and this is the function whose expectation is being taken, and it's divided by the same thing here, but you replace f of lambda by 1, and so that's just normalization. This is, in fact, if I were to put a equals 1 or 2, this would correspond to the application of one of the Vey integration theorems for integration over the set of Hermitian complex matrices, and the diagonalizing group is the unitary group, and this is the Jacobian of that transformation, and the volume element, the volume of the unitary group, is cancelled top and bottom. What you can show is that if this thing, the coefficient of p sub 2 to the m in that, is a ratio of two expectations, And this, if you put alpha equals 2, is the evaluation of, is the coefficient in a Schur function, and that is a character. So this, when you see that, when you see p sub 2, you should think of fixed point 3 involutions. And this is, in fact, computing a character, that basic character. And what you can show is that this map series, in which u has been replaced by 1, the x which counted the number of indeterminates now is replaced by a vector of indeterminates, which record vertex degrees, z records edges, b records some invariant, and n, it was the face marker, it now, unfortunately, is replaced by an integer. However, if you carry out the integration, and the theorem says that this thing is precisely equal to this, the log of this expectation operator, then if you give it a presentation in this ring of formal power series and this coefficient ring, and you expose n as taking part in a polynomial coefficient, then you can formally replace n by y. And now y marks faces. And the fancy way of saying that is that it's the fundamental theorem of algebra. So this is an example from the moduli space of curves, which I'm not going to go into. You can use a stable quadratic derivative to obtain a Searle decomposition for the moduli space of curves. And in fact, from that, by using by identifying edges, you can come up with a monopole. And a monopole is a map which has one vertex and a number of edges. And in fact, by taking a weighted sum, it's an alternating sum, and you have to divide by the order of some group which acts. You can compute the virtual Euler characteristic for the moduli space of curves. The case for complex curves was done by a well-known paper by Hara and Zagier. And then Hara and Gould and I combined and got the result for the real case, for real curves. Not only that, we also together expressed it in terms of this indeterminate B. So it seems that that this conjectured map invariant has a geometrical interpretation, presumably on the moduli space of complex curves. There are one or two geometers who are looking at that. This is beyond my ken in algebraic geometry. But the reason one can make this conjecture is because of the underlying conjecture about the embedding of maps in surfaces. Okay, this is part three, Faber's top intersection number conjecture. This is the result of current work with Ian Gould and Ravi Vakil, and it's ongoing. Ongoing as we speak, it is ongoing. So let this be the moduli space of smooth curves. Genus G within marked points, and this is its compactification. The intersection numbers are denoted by this symbol. It doesn't really matter if you're not familiar with this, because I shall be dealing with the combinatorics of it. These numbers add up to n to g minus 2 plus n plus k. Technically, this is some one-dimensional Chow class, and lambda sub k is a one-dimensional Chow class. And one part of Faber's conjecture, the intersection number part, deals with the case k equals 0, which corresponds to this thing on the left-hand side being maximal. So it corresponds to k equals 0. Faber's conjecture has two other parts. There's a Poincaré part, which is regarded by the geometers as being still inaccessible, There's a first part which has been proved by Druckenger. So the middle part of it simply says that this intersection number, whatever it is equal to this quotient of factorial-looking things. This is a double factorial. It's a product of a set of consecutive odd numbers. And this looks somewhat enticing, particularly since the conjecture is still open and is regarded as mysterious. When I said it's still open, it's rather hard to get actual current information about it. But suddenly, Getzler and Pandurpandi have proved that that this part of the conjecture is the consequence of yet another conjecture, the Virasoro conjecture, and for P2. Giebenthal has outlined a proof of that for PM. So in principle, there is a proof of Faber's top intersection number conjecture. And that would be for all G and all N. It's not known, I don't think anybody has seen it. I gather that Pandurpandi and one of his co-authors is thinking of writing a book on this proof. And I don't know whether Giebenthal has actually written this down as a paper, but it is in fact known through throughout the group of people who are familiar with the Faber intersection number conjecture. Well, Ian Goulden and Ravi Vakil and I propose an alternative approach, and this we believe to be more direct. And in the case which we have, it is more direct. The proof holds for all genera, and holding for all genera is quite hard. At the present moment, it works for we have it for 4 points, for 3 points, but we believe that that we can extend it. And our approach is through localization theorem, which originated in the work of Atiyah and Bott. Did I go over two then? Okay, so here's the outline of the proposed proof. We use localization theory to express the conjecture in terms of localization trees. I'm not running out of time, am I?
Let's see. I think you started a bit late.
So that, how long do I have?
A
couple of more minutes. Okay, I'll do my favorite thing, which is to whiz through these things very fast. We're going to use Hurwitz numbers, which count the number of ramified covers of a sphere by a curve of given genus. And it's going to have ramification over infinity, which is and zero, which is going to be arbitrary. And it's also going to have elementary ramification over the other points. And it's encoded as again in terms of permutations, just a product of transpositions, and a transitive ordered factorization. This generating series is called the top potential, and it has this geometric number in it. And that you can obtain by a topological recursion. The localization theory can be represented by a tree. This is a graph on three sets of vertices, zero vertices, infinity vertices, and one vertices. Notice that the graph is acyclic. Edges are marked with integers. And those integers define partitions, and on these infinity vertices, those two partitions, which are of equal weight by that balance condition, index a double Hurwitz number, which is a ramified, which counts ramified covers, and they are genus zero ramified covers. A ramified cover looks like this. This is a ramified cover of the sphere. This sort of blood-colored thing here. This green thing is meant to be a surface. Imagine it extended in both directions. Here is a staircase represented by a transposition 1-2. The application of 1-2 allows you to swap surfaces or swap sheets. This diagram is in fact connected because the action of that group is in fact transitive on these on these sheets. Here is ramification over infinity, and for double Hurwitz numbers, there's ramification over zero. This is in fact a Riemann surface, and it has a genus G. And I think I'm almost up to my last slide, which I'll skip over that. If this is the generating series for the double Hurwitz numbers, then it's easy to show that it satisfies a certain differential equation. This is a cut-join equation. Here is the weighted potential, which was the weight on that top vertex, the genus vertex, the root vertex, and this is this is a sum over all trees. Those are the weights. And the theorem says that you can in fact relate these two things by letting psi be this generating series. It's a tree generating series in terms of the F of J's, which satisfy this very complicated looking system of paired functional equations, where this is the generating series for the genus zero double Hurwitz numbers. And this is the series, these are the numbers which we are interested in. If you let FG be this, delta is this operator, and the star indicates the adjoint action of multiplying by P sub K, then this differential equation is satisfied by FG. So both of those things are defined now, and this is the link which connects them. And out of this, we've been able to set forth a proof for all genus of Faber's top number conjecture, intersection number. It holds for n equals 1, 2, and 3 at the present moment, and we believe that we understand how we can extend using the cut-join equation, and we can avoid knowing these things explicitly. We just need to know magical properties of this thing. And that's the end.